Thank you very much. I wanted to say, first of all, it's great to be back here, back in a familiar town, a town where Lee and I spent a lot of time. And I've been out with this book a little bit this fall, and the great problem with publishing is always the timing. A year or more passes between the final proofs and the book's release, and almost anything can happen in the meantime. My friend Curtis Wilkie had an actual pub date of 9/11/01 for his last book, and my friend Roy Blunt is out there somewhere right now trying to sell a book that's essentially an insider's walking tour of New Orleans. And that isn't funny, though Roy is. Compared with that, I can't complain, but my last book took me to Washington, D.C. 2 days after the undecided presidential election of 2000. And here I am again, while hurricanes are flattening a different Gulf state every few weeks, millions of Americans are refugees, most of the government is about to be indicted, or should be, and the Middle East is literally and figuratively bleeding this country to death. And here we come with our books, as if what we're saying and what we're selling is really as important as all those other things that you have on your mind. Most of us don't think so, believe me. And the ones who do, you shouldn't buy their books. But half the cities where I've been in the last few weeks, there were refugees in the audience, people who were either temporarily or permanently homeless. And I did feel like telling them that I was sorry I didn't have something that was more relevant, you know, to their situation. But even the least of these books represent a lot of effort. And so we head out, you know, like Willie Loman, sample cases in hand, and never mind the timing. But the other irony concerns the other writers who were out traveling on what we call the same cycle, who seem to be shadowing you from town to town, bookstore to bookstore. My shadow this year is Senator Trent Lott. Who I understand to be in Richmond tonight. Is that true? I just missed Senator Lott in Oxford and in Memphis. And strangely enough, there's an essay in my book that's not complimentary of Senator Lott or his mama or Senator Jesse Helms or the late Senator Strom Thurmond. And I was amazed to see that both Lott and Helms published books at this same time. Senator Thurmond has not. But there's nothing in their books that makes me think that he couldn't. Even now. Oddly enough, this is a really strange footnote. There's also a new autobiography from the 1950s movie star, Tab Hunter, who used to tell me his troubles, mostly romantic. You can think what you want about that, but I weighed 280 pounds at the time, so he probably wasn't trying to woo me. That was back when he was playing summer stock on Cape Cod, and I was the bartender at Latham's in Brewster. And if you buy his book, I've already heard all those stories. A review of a previous book of mine called Unarmed But Dangerous described my worldview this way. Hal Crowther not only sees the glass half empty, he thinks the water smells funny. Isn't that great? This new book, I think, is as much a serenade to the New South as it is a criticism. And though if you read it, you're bound to disagree with many of my opinions on politics, literature, music, race, religion, etc., you'll have to acknowledge that there's a lot of affection in this book, and even a fair amount of sentiment. Because this is an art museum, or the auspices of an art museum tonight, I'm going to read you a piece. There's only one Virginian in it. Actually, my last book had several specific Virginia essays, this one less so. But this is a story that I don't think will offend anyone. I can't imagine that it would, and it has a moral. though not a happy ending, and I've never read it anywhere else, and I'd like to try it out on you. This is called Portrait from Memory, A Prophet from Savannah. In college, most of us are too self-conscious and too anxious about our own uncertain fortunes to make accurate judgments of our peers. We're attracted to style without substance, often to individuals with neither, if a deadly jump shot or a famous family is part of the package they present. The hardest thing of all when you're a boy, it was a single-sex New England college that I attended, is to predict which of your contemporaries will become men who make genuine, lasting contributions to something greater than the alumni fund. Of the men I knew at Williams College, only two have been asked to come back and deliver the commencement address. One was a blowhard opportunist who achieved high office in Washington by endearing himself to right-wing politicians, and financial success as the author of lowbrow bestsellers urging Americans to tone up their morals. Eventually, he squandered most of his money and all of his political capital as a compulsive, high-rolling gambler, the kind of mega-sucker casinos milk solicitously in private rooms. You may or may not recognize it. The other commencement speaker was a much more interesting case. One Friday night in the fall of my junior year, I found myself uncharacteristically at a football pep rally with a towering bonfire and those large posters foretelling the mayhem that the Home 11 would soon inflict on Amherst. I noticed that the artwork on these posters was a great improvement over the previous years and asked if anyone knew who the artist might have been. Sophomore named Varnado, someone replied. Football player, lineman, a southerner. That was the first time I heard the name. On the Sunday after the last football game, while boys with thick necks and buzz cuts, liberated from training, stalked the campus in various stages of alcohol poisoning. I was in bed at noon, trying to sleep through a certain hangover. There was a rough knock on the door, and two imposing figures hovered over my bed. The larger one was an ex-Marine non-com named Westy Saltonstall, and the other, I rubbed my eyes and reached for my bifocals, appeared to be wearing an entire suit, jacket, and pants of cotton printed with Budweiser labels. Crowther! Croaked Saltonstall. Get dressed, you maggot. We're going to Cozy's. You know Kirk Varnado? Saltonstall, four beers into his Paris Island persona, was not a force that I ever chose to resist. If not the biggest, he was surely the oldest man on campus, and his family had held half the first class tickets on the Mayflower, or so we provincials believed. I pulled on my jeans while the kid in the bud suit grinned at me. Did Kirk Varnado make a vivid first impression? Well, his suit did. Drinking was ritualized at Williams to a degree that makes me cringe today. Drinking uniforms and accessories were not uncommon. One clown in KA wore a horned Viking helmet, like Hagar the Horrible in the comics. I myself owned a hard hat with my name stenciled on it from a summer job in the steel mills. Even so, the bud suit was a statement. I guess Kirk was saying, I'm from Savannah, where people party seriously, whether you Yankees know it or not. Those who dressed to drink often overplayed their roles, in my opinion, but this sophomore had a nice, recognizably Southern reserve about him. After all these years, I thought I might have imagined the suit, a drinker's hallucination. But among Kirk's many obituaries last summer, I found the same suit mentioned by Marsha Vetrock, who knew him in graduate school at Stanford. I wonder who's wearing it now. It was a limited secret that Varnado, by Williams standards, was a drinker of no epic capacity, who sometimes suffered grievously for weekend excesses. Another secret I can guess at, because it was my secret too. The part of Williams we inhabited held hard work and serious study in serious contempt. So our academic enthusiasms and best grades remain carefully concealed from many of our friends. Varnadel must have been taking in something besides liquid calories at Williams, because 6 years later, he had a PhD in art history and was already an acknowledged expert on Rodin. He taught at Columbia and NYU, and at 38, won a MacArthur Genius Grant, an honor that at least symbolically left all the rest of us behind. At 42, a professor with no museum experience, he was named curator of painting and sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art. It was and is the most influential job in the fluid, insular, fiercely contentious world of modern art. Just 2 decades past his last Amherst game, the lineman from Savannah was sitting in the chair where the most critical decisions in his profession were made. Quote, the conscientious, continuous, resolute distinction of quality from mediocrity, unquote, according to his Olympian predecessor, Alfred Barr. The modern and his chief curator serve the American art establishment as a kind of aesthetic Supreme Court, and most of their rulings are beyond appeal. The seat of power was the culmination of a spectacular rise, and Varnadel gave every appearance of having been born for the job. With his rough-sketched Barrymore profile, his low-country manners, and the Italian suits that somewhere replaced his blood jacket, and his stylish, talented wife, the sculptor Ellen Zimmerman, he added a glamour that was brand new to the museum trade and catnip to the celebrity-hungry tabloids that patrol Manhattan society. Outside New York, in the cloistered art world, the name Varnadel may not be a household word. None of his 18 books can be purchased in airports. But among artists and art professionals, his was a presence you could only compare to Tiger Woods at Augusta or Russell Crowe. When he delivered the Mellon Lectures at the National Gallery in 2003, not long before he died, the museum was forced to rig extra auditoriums with audio relays. The lines would not have been longer if Picasso had come back from the dead to sign autographs. Our Georgia boy was the closest thing to a rock star that art history has ever produced. Marcia Vetrock, his friend at Stanford, remembered him in just such an aura. A motorcycle-riding rock star, impossibly handsome, in a sea of sun-deprived academics. We were all proud of Varnadel, but of course we were amazed. Neither the talent nor the glamour had been readily apparent at school. His trademark rendition of the scabrous 58-verse rugby ballad, Eskimo Nell, provoked an international incident on a flight to London. According to the Williams College Rugby Club, they offered a consensus. Anyone who knew Kirk in the 60s finds it hard to believe that he is now so well respected. What do we remember? Obviously, he was thoughtful, cut from different cloth than the guy with the Viking helmet. He'd give you this loopy grin, but if you paid attention, you could see that something else was happening with his eyes. Alert he was, curious, aware. But an alpha intellectual, an A-list celebrity, a sex symbol for the girls of Mensa? As his brother Sam said about the young Kirk in his eulogy, the kid was bright, fun, engaging. He wasn't remarkable. Some inevitable connection between the boy and the man has always been a leap of faith for biographers, a bridge of suggestion where insight and scholarship fail. Modern celebrity is much complicated by the media and the combustible cult of celebrity itself. Simon Garfunkel sang, "The spotlight hit the boy," in another context, and he flew away. Varnadel was puzzled by his own image. You don't study art history to become rich and famous. It isn't like buying a guitar and a spangled bodysuit and driving to Nashville. Kirk had a comical response when the New York City gossip kittens labeled him a hunk and a dreamboat. He looked in the mirror. If the definition of beauty is symmetry, this ain't it, he told an old friend from Savannah. My face is skewed to the right because my jaw juts one way, and my forehead's out of balance, and my ears don't match, and I have these moles all over the place. The whole was actually more photogenic than the sum of its parts. But aside from the occasional photograph at a black tie function surrounded by famous faces, the man we knew at Williams seemed essentially unchanged, though his hair, by my rural standards, got a little spiky for a while in the 90s. He was loyal to a fault. When he delivered the commencement at Williams, he might have quoted Alfred Barr, Clement Greenberg, or some such oracle of modern art. Instead, he quoted me from a reactionary drinking essay, The Night People, that I'd published in the Williams Record as a parting shot. When Varnado organized his first major exhibition at the Modern, a controversial show called High and Low, Modern Art and Popular Culture, many art critics were brutally dismissive, but none of them noted that he'd commissioned the show's video guide from an old rugby buddy who was down on his luck. He kept up with people, and if the old crowd never seemed to resent his conspicuous success, as they sometimes resented classmates who became corporate overlords, it was partly because he cut a prominent figure in a field they scarcely understood. For most of us, the great Varnado was just an excellent adventure that we could share vicariously. This tendency to exempt him from envy was not shared by the art community, never known for its easygoing magnanimity. Kirk was a flashy, well-connected outsider who never earned his stripes in the curatorial boot camps, and the intramural sniping commenced even before he was installed at the Modern. One bone of fierce contention was an ad for Barney's Men's Store, photographed by Annie Leibovitz, with a mugging Varnado looking suave and surly in a suit by Amenegildo Zegna. A neglected footnote was that his modeling fee went to the Coalition for the Homeless. But by the time High and Low went up in 1990, wolves were circling and salivating. A textbook case for the maxim that an exhibition top-heavy with masterpieces can still be a disaster, sniffed Roberta Smith of the New York Times, who was a special enemy of the curator she chose to see at the time as a presumptuous South Georgia playboy. Retrospectives for the Southern-born painters Cy Twombly and Jasper Johns were more successful, but the ad hominem backbiting never abated until the announcement in 1996 that he was being treated for advanced colon cancer. That's New York for you. According to Robert Storr, his colleague at the Modern, Varnado was often wounded by the intemperate nature of some of the attacks. If so, they weren't wounds that he ever licked in public. We'd been out of touch after I left New York, though he always sent me invitations to his openings. But I began to see Kirk more often in the 90s. The meanness he had provoked was a mystery to me, just as it was a mystery why all other museum curators were invisible scholars, and Kirk was like Sky Masterson in Guys and Dolls. It was in 1998, when he'd apparently recovered from his cancer, that I finally began to understand what the boy in the bud suit had made of himself and why I should pay attention. He just opened his Jackson Pollock retrospective to wide acclaim. He invited a few of his Williams friends to tour the exhibition at 8 a.m. before the museum opened and educated us painting by painting as we walked through it with our wives. In all honesty, I had never been a Pollock enthusiast. English majors with our weakness for narrative structure are resistant to abstract expressionism. And Pollock's neurotic chaos is especially intimidating to us. But after an hour of looking at Pollock's paintings through Varnado's eyes, I saw Pollock as I'd never seen him before. But more dramatically, I saw Varnado as I'd never seen him before. At 50, he was a spellbinder, as they used to call him, who could have sold Pollock to the Pre-Raphaelites or Andy Warhol soup cans to Cosimo de' Medici. It's hard to admit that someone you knew as a teenager is a genius of any kind. Yet here was a genius of the lectern at the top of his form. It was a privilege to watch him work with the paintings themselves. At the Mellon lectures, I learned that he was just as good with a carousel of slides, a magician like Ricky Jay with a deck of playing cards. He could dazzle and hypnotize, And when I asked him for the text of his lectures, he explained, with mixed pride and sheepishness, that he never lectured from any text or even from notes. The same memory that conquered 58 verses of Eskimo Now, which is just nasty, scabrous stuff, had somehow absorbed the entire chronicle and spectacle of modern art. Preacherly was a word someone used to describe him at the podium. Art is my religion, he told TV's Charlie Rose. And I recalled the classroom style of Lane Fazin, his mentor, the legendary Williams art professor, still lecturing at 98, whose students now run about half of America's major museums. Fazin, also a maestro of the slide projector, approached the study of art as if it were some vigorous outdoor sport, some voyage of discovery for hardy, bronzed sailors, not sun-deprived academics. Varnadeau was Fazin's perfect disciple. His former student, New Yorker critic Adam Gopnik, said, for Kirk, art was as physical and pleasurable as being knocked down by a wave. From his ideal perch at the Modern, he became the prophet, high priest, and principal evangelist for his own cult. Of strenuous engagement, his church for estho athletes, driven to probe and pierce and wrestle with works of art until they yielded their secrets. If art can spawn Fauvism, Dadaism, and the Ashcan school, why should I hesitate to coin a name for his own faith? Sinuism seems to work. My coinage may not catch on with art historians, but research reveals that Kirk loved the word sinew and used it often. Giacometti's sculptures, he found the resilient sinews of humanity. Genius and hard work notwithstanding, friends say he worked 18-hour days. It was a miracle of good fortune for Varnadeau to win the one job on this planet where his gifts and passions could make the biggest difference. Such favors are rarely granted by the gods, and the gods never fail to exact a price. He spent 14 years at the Modern, half of them in the shadow of a life-threatening illness. The cancer recurred in 2001 and eventually metastasized. As treatments began to fail him, he put the last of his strength into his Mellon lectures, a six-part, nine-hour defense of abstract art titled Pictures of Nothing, which became one of those triumphs of will and spirit that eyewitnesses make into stories to tell their children. His final lecture was an eloquent flight of free association. None of us who were there, not even those few who raised the glass with him afterwards, could point to any sign that this was not a man at the peak of his powers. Less than 3 months later, he was dead at 57. To the last, Kirk considered himself a lucky man, wrote Marcia Vetrick, echoing the last public words of a New York idol of another era, the great Lou Gehrig, dying of MLS. Said Gehrig, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Gehrig was another big, good-looking jock who in his life was dealt many good hands and one very bad one. Varnadeau chose to introduce his final lecture with the less quoted last words of the android Roy Batty, played by Rutger Hauer in Ridley Scott's film Blade Runner. Some of you may recognize this quote. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe, attack ships on fire, off the shoulder of Orion, bright as magnesium. I rode on the back decks of a blinker and watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in the rain. Time to die. A certain percentage of the overflow audience understood that Varnadeau was dying, and at these words, of course, that percentage was in tears. There it is, he concluded when his last slide faded from the screen. I've shown it to you. It has been done. It is being done. Because it can be done, it will be. And now I am done. I never saw him again after that astonishing Sunday at the National Gallery. The apostle of sinuism had issued his last encyclical. But once you've heard a great preacher, you're bound to sample his version of the gospel. His books and essays have been a revelation to me as much as his virtuosity in the pulpit. Of course, we assign the highest intelligence to those who agree with us. And without ever discussing anything philosophical, sports and friends and maybe France made up the whole of our conversations. This brilliant Varnado and I had arrived at many of the same conclusions. He used his influence to oppose the dreary, reductive Marxism and Marx-inflected theory that casts us all, even artists, as helpless prisoners of our own narrow context. Everything an artist creates is predictable, according to these grim anti-humanist heretics, if we can fix him within the correct contextual coordinates. To these theorists, art is an incidental byproduct of the class struggle, and genius, inspiration, even talent and quality are decadent, repressive, elitist notions. Anyone who ever loved art or literature believes intuitively that this is Philistine rubbish, that it's always what can't be predicted, what's individual and eccentric, the sudden insight, the rogue notion that lights up the canvas, the page, and the world. Against reductive theory, Varnado declared his belief in the individual human consciousness for all its flaws and deforming optics as our prime resource and treasure. The title of his most definitive book on modern art, A Fine Disregard, comes from the story that rugby was invented when an English soccer player, displaying what his commemorative plaque calls a fine disregard for the rules, suddenly picked up the ball and ran with it. Varnado scorned inevitability. He worshipped the random. As a literary critic, I've declared the same faith and fought the same fight against the same ferocious Philistines. Somehow we belong to the same church, Varnado and I. Was there any significance in the fact, confirmed after Kirk's death by his brother Sam, that we both carried not-so-secret torches for Emmylou Harris? He also loved Elvis and Sam Cooke. The novelist Kurt Vonnegut, with whom Kirk was occasionally confused, invented the concept of the carass, a group of people with something important but subtle in common. Opposed to the crass was the Grand Falloon, a group with something utterly superficial in common, like Williams College alumni. Often as not, what intrigued him also intrigued me, especially the book that he never wrote but mentioned in every interview, his book on how, quote, how Rauschenberg, Johns, and Twombly from Lexington, three Southern boys, changed the world. In the near century since H.L. Mencken dismissed the South as the Sahara of the Beaux-Arts, Southern artists have struggled to be taken seriously by the New York Mandarins, in many cases, even by their own regional museums. It was no coincidence that Varnado, a Southerner unexpectedly appointed chief Mandarin, devoted his major retrospectives to Johns and Twombly. As loyal to his roots as to his friends, he had big plans for the South's undernourished reputation, but he ran out of time. Varnado's eye, of course, was no layman's eye, and the Southern accents in his own work are never hard to find. His simile for Alberto Giacometti's irony, quote, as earthy as the slouch of a loping hound, left me grinning conspiratorially. Only a Southerner with Kirk's discernment and tenacity could ever have sold this worldly trio back to the home folks or sold them to anyone as Dixie's darling. He had a theory about Twombly, that Civil War-saturated Lexington with its monuments and sites sacred to Lee and Stonewall Jackson had turned the artist toward military mythology and paintings like his series 50 Days at Ilium. Certainly, armed ghosts haunt the South. Jasper Johns took his first name from a Revolutionary War hero, Sergeant William Jasper, whose statue you can find in a Savannah square. Johns, well, he painted American flags, and his stepfather was named Robert E. Lee. But that's pretty thin. and Rauschenberg's echoes seem much thinner to me. Varnadoe's last email a week before his death promised me a couple of sentences of insight into this pet project. They never came, and I've been looking for clues ever since. Even the most illustrious career leaves much undone, much unsaid. Taking advantage of the unrestrained hospitality of his sister, I made a respectful pilgrimage to Savannah. Touring the famous squares, I encountered Sergeant Jasper and a dozen houses connected to Kirk's family, branches of which have been prominent in the city for centuries. I stayed in the rambling beach cottage on Tybee Island. I ate oysters with his brother Gordon at the Crab Shack, and I walked through the ancestral hunting cabin, now decomposing in the pine woods. I saw the big brick house on the square where he grew up, and portraits of Johnny Unitas and Ray Charles that he drew when he was a boy. His sister and I stood on the bluff where a few bricks remain of the family's last big house, Bewley, which burned in 2001. And finally, the Varnadoe grave sites under a huge live oak smothered in Spanish moss on a bluff overlooking the river and the salt marshes. Deep south, with all the trimmings, scenes from Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil were filmed just down the river. Several graves were flying Confederate battle flags, and nearby is a headstone for Kirk's cousin, Braxton Bragg Comer. The footprints end there, light years from the museum on 53rd Street in Manhattan. All in all, a Southerner's life that showed a fine disregard for the rules and managed to change a few. Maybe it's not too grand to recycle Jasper John's epitaph for Marcel Duchamp. Quote, he has changed the condition of being here. Thank you. There's a shorter one that also is about art that I will finish up with here. I should introduce the subject a little bit. This is much lighter. This is a painter from North Carolina who was also a well-known evangelist. And he painted these terrifying visions, these visions of hell and the pit of hell and Christ with a sword destroying sinners. And they're absolutely terrifying. They look like outsider art, but they're very beautifully done. He happened to have trained in Paris and have been a very serious portrait painter before he went into religious art. And they're some of the most shocking things that you'll ever see. His family hated them so much that they buried them in the basement for many years until an art historian saw one of them, and since then they've been circulating. They haven't been to the museum here, have they? McKendree Long? I don't know, but you may still be able to get them if you'd like to. But you won't forget them if you see them. And they asked me to comment on these paintings, and I did. This is called Sacred Art, Southern Fried, Harlots and Hellfire. It's not well known that I was once, for a very short run, an actual salaried art critic for a large northern newspaper. But it's my reputation as an independent theologian that best qualifies me to comment on the paintings of the late Reverend McKendree Long. As a lapsed Unitarian, I fall at the opposite end of the theological spectrum from Reverend Long. Maybe the only thing we had in common, to judge by his famous Lady in Red paintings, was a taste for the sort of woman that the tabloids call statuesque. Surely I'd be among the lost souls that he sent hurtling into the lake of fire in their bathing suits or less. Members of my family have even been guilty of that heresy known as universalism, the bland and beautiful belief that everyone is saved, whether they like it or not. The final harmony of all souls with God, and that even if you end up in hell somehow, it's only temporary. It just meant that you and God needed to get a few things straight between you. I myself once wrote in an art review, I have never been able to follow the notion of God's plan, much beyond the boundaries of the human ego. I suppose I'd be a secular humanist if I had a little more faith in humans. I'm profoundly uncomfortable with some of the images in Long's paintings of Christ with a sword or a bloody sickle, of God orchestrating colossal slaughters and mass extinctions of human and animal life. Toward what end, we're not really sure, except to confirm to individuals like McKendry Long that they were right all along, that God is as uncompromising and unforgiving as that face they see in the mirror every morning. When it comes to scripture, I line up with the British writer Zadie Smith, who declares in her wonderful novel, White Teeth, "The book of Revelation is the last stop on the Nutso Express." No one knows much about this man, John, who wrote the book of Revelation on the island of Patmos sometime around 100 AD. Few scholars still believe that he was John, the disciple of Christ. All we know is that he had a lurid and spectacular imagination, like McKendry Long, and that every period of Christian history has produced new and increasingly bizarre interpretations of his prophecy. If I were a biblical scholar, I'd make a study of the vegetation on the Isle of Patmos to see if Patmos grows anything recognizably hallucinogenic. But in present time, John's Nutso Express is carrying more passengers than ever before, including American fundamentalists who are rooting for World War III in the Middle East because it suits their timetable for Armageddon. A man named Dale Pollitt came to our hometown last month with a video illustrated lecture series, The Time of the Beast, including a lecture revealing 9 ways to identify the Antichrist. A crystal clear revelation of who the Antichrist is. First class passengers on the express also include the Reverend Pat Robertson of Virginia Beach, an educated gentleman evangelist like McKendry Long, whose book, The End of the Age, prophesied that Christ would return in the year 2000 in a spaceship, a jeweled cube measuring 1,400 miles on each side. Reverend Robertson also ran for president in 1988 and won more delegates at the Republican convention than anyone except George H.W. Bush and Bob Dole. Speaking of politics, the work of McKendry Long reminds us that it's profoundly important to keep church and state separate, as nearly all the founding fathers, mostly deists, Unitarians, or agnostics, and not one of them fundamentalist, insisted from the start. If you believe you're doing exactly what God demands, as Pat Robertson does, why should you care what anyone else thinks? Pat knows what to do with God's enemies, with you and me and the president of Venezuela. And Reverend Long's grandson recalls, for me, quote, "Whatever disagreed with him at the moment, Grandpa put him in the picture." That is, into the lake of fire or the bottomless pit. From Long, we got these wonderful paintings. But imagine what secular humanists would get from President Robertson if he truly believed that the Antichrist was on the march. When you look at the lineup of great souls headed for the lake of fire, you see immediately what the Reverend has in mind. Damn Bacon, damn Voltaire, damn Darwin, and Huxley, and Einstein, and Freud. Long is throwing out the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, virtually every step forward in human comprehension since the Dark Ages. After savoring some of his heavy-breathing Lady in Red paintings, I thought that Reverend Long should have booked a few hours of Dr. Freud's professional services before he pitched him into the flames. But what he's really saying is that nothing worth reading has been written since John ate those mushrooms on Patmos in 95 AD. In this particular exhibition, with his letters and poetry to cross-reference, we could begin to understand how Long's personal torments might have led him to certain theological extremes. Think of Jimmy Swaggart, another multi-talented evangelist who sublimated sex inadequately, as I recall, on a keyboard instead of a canvas. But how did this revolt against reason and tolerance come to so afflict the South that to some outlanders it still appears, as H.L. Mencken described it, a cesspool of crazy Baptists, a miasma of crooked Methodists, snake charmers, and syphilitic evangelists? There's a book by Christine Herrmann called Southern Cross that contradicts the impression that the South has always been this way. Evangelism came late to the American South, she writes, as an exotic import. She portrays the South of the 18th century as the homeland of easygoing Anglicans, doubters, deists, and independent, contentious freethinkers, epitomized by Thomas Jefferson, regarded by early fundamentalists as the Antichrist himself. When the Church of England all but abandoned America after the Revolution, migrating Scots, Irish, and Germans brought hellfire evangelism south along the Appalachians. But it took more than a century of struggle and ample ridicule before evangelicals achieved the dominance that Mencken deplored. Take care for those Baptists, for they will not rest till they dip you. One good Virginia Episcopalian warned his neighbors in 1818. In 1776, evangelicals claimed only 10% of church membership in the South. By the War of 1812, still less than 20%. North Carolina was one of the first places where exotic theology appeared to thrive. Herrmann describes it in 1785 as, quote, a place in the South akin to what Rhode Island had been in New England, a remote exile for those whose religious eccentricities embarrassed more sober Christians. But Baptists and Methodists adapted and gained strength, according to Herrmann, by backing away from what we might now see as their strengths, their early opposition to slavery, and their concern for the poor and for the rights of women. But as late as 1822, the great Thomas Jefferson felt so confident of their final failure and of the rational potential of his countrymen that he committed a piece of prophecy more doomed and naive than the worst of Pat Robertson, McKendry Long, or John of Patmos. I trust, said Jefferson, that there is not a young man now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian.